Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock from Australia. Our guest is scientist Andrew Glickson. We're talking about extreme climate change in the past and in our future. Given the recent record burst of carbon dioxide in 2010 and the failure of any political solution at the Durban climate talks, my question to you, Andrew Glickson, is it possible we are already committed to global warming that will endanger all coming human generations?
That's a $64 trillion question. I often wonder whether around the 1970s, actually 1975-76, all the trajectories were steepening up, rise in global temperature and ice melt rates and a lot of other parameters have steepened up since that time. It looks as if it might have been a tipping point, but of course tipping points are very difficult to define. I wonder whether at that point, if the global effort was made, attempted to sequester carbon dioxide, which was already, I think, 330 parts per million, whether it would have worked, that's given reforestation and even chemical sequestration of CO2. I mean, humans have put a man on the moon, and they've achieved incredible things. The question is, in that case, why not manage to sequester carbon dioxide? Because cutting an emission is no longer sufficient, it seems to me. We are now at 393 parts per million and getting close to the stability threshold or limit of the Antarctic ice sheet, which is considered 500 plus minus 50. Could humans do it in the mid-70s? Well, I hope so. And this is now, what, 30 years ago, so. This was then. Could they do it then? Now, I really don't know now. If they put the trillions of dollars which are spending on military purposes around the world into an attempt to stabilize the atmosphere, could they have done it? Well, I don't think we have an answer, but I think there would have been possibly a 50-50% chance.
Well, you know, some governments seem to accept that carbon dioxide levels will double from the pre-industrial levels. Can you tell us what that might mean in terms of climate change?
Well, governments might accept it. I don't know whether the atmosphere will accept it. That's where the huge disconnect occurs between humans and between physics, atmospheric physics and chemistry. What would it mean? Well, I'm certainly glad that I will not be around to witness that.
Do you have any figure of what you think the upper level of warming is before our civilization might collapse? I know that's quite a question to ask any scientist, but would you hazard a guess?
Well, a collapse of any civilization, including in the past, does not occur at a single point of time. It's a protracted thing, and when we look now at the spate of extreme weather events around the world, we look at the floods in Pakistan. Well, do they say it's a 1 in 100 years event? Well, this 1 in 100 years event are becoming now far more frequent, and the frequency of extreme weather events around the world has doubled over the last decade or so. That's according to numbers of the Munich Reinsurance Corporation. Or look at events like the cyclones now around the world. Look at the fires. Well, fire is another subject altogether, although closely related. I don't know that we have a single tipping point, and I don't know that we can talk about a point in time of collapse of civilization. It looks more like a series of disasters.
Andrew, it seems strange that countries like Canada, which have been hit hard by climate change, we lost all our pine forests here in British Columbia because of insect damage in the warming, and Australia has been burned and flooded in record ways, and yet both of our countries have many self-appointed experts who deny that climate change exists. Even Texas, look at that, it was burned out with a horrid drought, and they elected many, many denier politicians. How difficult is that problem for you as a scientist when you know very well what is happening to our climate?
Oh, it feels, Alex, insane. It feels as if there are a number of reasons. There are people who don't understand the scientific method. There's also, psychologically, don't accept a news of development of this magnitude. There are vested interests. But the people who deny the science, some of them go to the extent of changing the numbers on the climate plots and climate trends. Now, this is something which in science, certainly in medical science, but all of science, once you've done it, you're not a scientist any longer. You're something else. It does feel insane, but it does feel, I mean, I look at this issue, as you know, to a large extent in terms of deep time. And science is a very recent development in human history. It's only developed just about from the time that actually combustion has developed, strangely enough, in the 16th, 17th century. But before then, well, we have the medieval times. We have times when superstition, the Inquisition and all the rest, all these charming ways of life and belief have existed. And we now take science for granted, but we can't. Science is a very fragile search for reality, search for the truth. It doesn't take much for humans to discard those observations which do not fit their wishes of their vested interests.
Yeah, it's kind of funny to think, you know, Francis Bacon, I think, helped develop modern science because he saw this long age of religious delusion before him, and he wanted us to test our ideas against the reality around us. And yet the politicians, and to be honest, each one of us to some degree, seem happier with our delusions about fossil fuels. I don't see a way past this fatal bottleneck right now.
Well, they don't get it. But there are real reasons why people don't get what happens. Because say if it was, and I go back to asteroids, say that asteroid was approaching Earth, it would have been plain obvious that every day and every week the asteroid in the sky, which you see at night as a glowing point, is getting bigger. People would look at it and start to get worried. It's getting bigger. The same thing with the human instinct about human enemies or wars. Let's see an army building up at the border. That's obvious. That's what happened in World War II, and that's how Churchill, he was able to mobilize the British people. But with the climate and the weather, for one thing, the distinction is very difficult. Climate is a longer-term accumulation of the weather, just on a time scale. Weather is what? Days, maybe weeks. Climate is years and decades. And we live in the weather. We don't live in the climate, like day in and day out. So the problem is somewhat intractable, because those who deny the science always pick on days and weeks at which it's nice and cool, like it is now. And people want good news. People have to live another day. Over most of the world, people have to put food on the table. We in the suburbia international, the privileged ones, well, we don't want to give up our privileges, and we live in air-conditioned, climate-controlled. Modern cars have a button for climate control. So people actually believe that technology can fix everything. That's almost a form of religious belief, to think that we can populate other planets, like some people believe in that. Once the Earth is too damaged, we can always jump onto Mars and damage that too. Oh, sorry, I've been carried away.
Well, we've all been carried away, and I like where you go.
That's what you do. I mean, those who don't accept the science, the poor carbon people, they say, oh no. They say there always have been climate changes, there always have been extreme weather events. They are muddying the water by changing the data sets and by appealing to basic human needs to feel optimistic, live another day. I mean, I perfectly understand it. I very often wish that I could deny the science.
Yes, I'd like to not be broadcasting what I'm broadcasting, because it's very depressing, you know, for people.
It's very depressing. I'm sorry about it. I find it hard to talk to young people about it nowadays.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't talk to my kids about it too much. And yet we broadcast on a lot of college stations, so there are young people definitely listening, and it's their future. And I'm happy to say that there are a lot more young activists coming out and saying, we're just not going to put up with this anymore.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me sometimes that it requires people's change of mindset almost to be able to, I mean, in many areas and places, it still looks like a theoretical, like in a big city where people live in air-conditioned offices and all the rest of it, and the majority of suburbia is pretty well protected within the system that we have. And they are the people who have the resources. They're the people who have the political power. It's not the the wretched of the earth right out there in the so-called third world or developing world. They are the ones who are suffering for more than one reason. One, they're not very well protected. They don't have the resources to protect themselves. The other, as it happens, some of these areas are the worst damaged.
Andrew Glickson, would you pick out two or three scientific papers or reports you've published in the last few months and just tell us about them?
Well, I published, there was a paper called Milestone in the Evolution of the Atmosphere and Climate Change. I published it in 2008 in the Australian Journal of Earth Science. There is other papers, there is a paper in the Journal of Cosmology. I have about the world at 4 degrees and Homo sapiens in the atmosphere. And, there are other papers. I publish quite a bit on the internet nowadays as well.
And where do people find that?
There are references in the URLs, so the detailed references, I can send them to you. Like, say, if they Google in my name, Andrew Glickson, and Australian Journal of Earth Science, or the Journal of Cosmology, and so on, then they will get it on the Internet.
Okay, well, I'll tell listeners that is spelled G-L-I-K-S-O-N.
That's right.
I'll post some of those links in my blog at ecoshock.info. Well, as we wrap up, I'm wondering, there must be some important things that I've missed, something else that you would like to talk about. I'll hand you the microphone. What would you like to say?
Well, thank you very much. It's about, what is it, 7,000-8,000 miles to end the microphone across. So we have to make sure it doesn't drop into the Pacific Ocean. Well, I myself, being a geologist by training, my way of to cope with the evidence is not to think that it's some particular individuals, even whether it's the billionaires nowadays or the corporations or some governments, who are responsible. Even though it looks as if they are, for doing nothing and even abusing climate scientists and threatening them and all the rest, my way of thinking goes into the natural origins of the time we're living in. And like I was saying before, for a species to develop, the level of energy, which induces a level of entropy in nature, as humans have, that species will have to be capable of being responsible to the extent of almost being perfect, of not allowing this energy to get out of control and create damage in the environment. And I will have to, in ethical terms, forgive, in inverted commas, our own species for not being perfect. We would have had to be perfect to control whether it's fire, whether it's combustion, or whether it's nuclear energy, for that matter, very much so. It's another form of climate change. I have to, when I think about it in terms of deep time and in terms of ethics, forgive, in inverted commas, the species for not being perfect, not being able to control this enormous power that has developed. Not something anyone designed. It's just part of evolution. Now, this helps me cope with it. Whether it's true or not is a question, philosophical or scientific question, we can always discuss. But it helps me cope with it because there is a degree of acceptance here. It's a bit like, or very much like religious people who say, God has given, God has taken, be God's name, be blessed. It's the same sentiment, even though not the same explanation, which sees natural evolution as the prime factor. It's very much like sailing on the sea. You see all these little waves, but really what you don't see are the deep ocean currents below, hundreds of meters below, which control the behavior of the ocean. That's the way I think, but other people and other scientists, they have their own ways of coping with the situation. A lot of them still think that if the global powers now made a decision, then the switch could be reversed, or rather, the levers could be reversed, and we will move on to stable climate.
Well, I have to agree with your assessment. I'm not a Marxist, but Karl Marx did say that he thought that the people at the top were just as deluded as the workers at the bottom. So, you know, I don't tend to blame this politician or that politician, especially when I'm still thinking, well, gee, I would love to get on an airplane and visit with my daughter in another city. And yet by doing that, I'd be creating climate gases and making the problem worse and just deluding myself. So I'm part of the delusion. I think we all are. And whether we can change as some species wheel about, the way birds wheel about, the way fish sometimes move all together, that's kind of my hope, is that there will come a point where humans might be able to act together. We can't be perfect, but we could sure be a lot better.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, Alex. I certainly do.
Well, you've been listening to prominent Australian scientist Dr. Andrew Glickson. He's been the principal research scientist for the Australian Geological Survey Organization. Now he works with the Australian National University and the Planetary Science Institute. I'll post some links to Dr. Glickson's work in my blog at ecoshock.info. And Andrew, we've talked by email for years. It's been a real great pleasure for me to finally meet on radio.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Alex, for inviting me, and certainly look forward to future communication, and I wish you all the very best in your very important work.
Thank you. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We go into our next climate science interview with this quick clip from michellemontecrosa.com.
Is producing obsolete technologies in abundance far out. The sun is lurking in dark space, waiting. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la.
From the University of Washington in Seattle, our guest is William H. Calvin. He is a theoretical neurobiologist and author of a dozen books, including A Brain for All Seasons, Human Evolution and Abrupt Climate Change. Professor Calvin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to say we only have time for a brief meeting in this program. Your work is deep. I've just watched several of your full lectures on YouTube, and I barely scratched the surface. Perhaps we can talk about a few key questions. First of all, can you describe your theory that climate change helped develop the human brain?
Well, one of the big mysteries in human evolution is the increase in brain size, because our brain is about, you know, 3 to 4 times larger than that of the chimpanzees and also of the hominid ancestors back in the 6 to 3 million year time period. But then the Ice Age has started, you know, series of climate changes, which everyone sort of imagined as being slow and gradual, and brain size started increasing then. And that's also when tool making became visible, at least in the archaeologists' collections. So this sort of triple puzzle of what did these three things have to do with one another, increasing brain size, increasing tool making, and the ice ages, you know, how do those fit together? That's where I started on the problem.
And then another striking feature of your recent presentation that I saw at the University of Victoria is, and we're moving into the present now, is the number of abrupt climate incidents in the last 40 years. Can you give us a couple of examples of that?
Okay. Scientists have been concerned about abrupt climate changes, the sort of thing where it's as fast as a drought. In other words, within just 1 or 2 years, you're in big trouble. That sort of thing was seen in the ice core records of the climate of the last ice age. In other words, it turned out not to be sort of a gradual roller coaster of temperature change, but it turned out to be superimposed on that a number of just really big jumps in climate. So for example, it would cool down from a sort of a warm and wet climate like today into a cooler, drier, windy, dusty kind of ice age environment. And, of course, the glaciers would start to respond to that by spreading. But basically, these changes only last a few centuries, and then they pop back the other direction. So, for example, it could rewarm, more than 10 to 20 degrees Celsius in just 2 or 3 years. And that sort of rapid change is what's comes to mind in most scientists' minds when they hear the words abrupt climate change. In the last 40 years, we've had abrupt changes, but they haven't been in temperature. The ones back during the ice ages were temperature change simultaneous with drought, simultaneous with high winds and a lot of dust in the air. The ones we're having now are best recorded in drought. That is to say, a Texas-style drought in severity used to occur in about 14% of the world's land surface. Between 1950 and 1982, that was the average. There was no particular trend. It just varied from 12% up to 18% in that territory. In 1982, it suddenly doubled. And you might think that was just an exceptionally bad year of some sort, just one of those once in 2,000-year events. But it turned out that it lasted for 15 years. So it just stayed up at double. So about 28% or so of the world's land surface was in Texas-style drought in the given year. Then in 97, it jumped up to triple and stayed up at triple for about 7 or 8 years and then suddenly jumped back down to double. So we've got a series of three abrupt worldwide climate shifts. Now, local regions have these sort of, I wouldn't say all the time, but they're fairly common. It's just that you don't have so much of the world's land surface doing it all at once. It's the synchronicity of all the droughts worldwide that's the unusual feature of this. So those are three examples of abrupt, climate change. And it turns out there are others that if you study the record, you recognize there's at least a half dozen that have occurred since 1976. So that's the sort of thing that we can look at the record of global warming and we can see that the temperature has been, at least since 1976, has been pretty steadily rising. And there have been a whole series of rainfall changes that have also been occurring. But drought is often a rearrangement of the rainfall pattern. It's not necessarily the total. Most typical way you get a drought, I suppose, is when sort of the ocean air streams that come onshore to land carry a lot of moisture, divert and go ashore someplace else. So you get a drought in the region that was normally going to get them, and you get floods in the other place.
Well, related to that, you've also said that since the Earth days of the 1970s, the green prescription to fix things has not changed very much, but our situation has become very much more serious. And you're suggesting it's too late to stick with those old solutions. Can you talk to us about that?
Okay. Well, first of all, whether you have climate change or not, the green solutions represent a very logical thing to do. And it's a whole list of useful things that existed before anyone got very worried about climate. Climate is just an additional reason to do them and do them quickly. I mean, what I'm suggesting now is that we have accumulated so much more CO2 in the air since the 1970s that simply stopping doing what caused it is no longer a good solution because the CO2 stays in the air. You've got to do something to take it out of the air if you want the temperature to come back down in time, for, say, your children's or grandchildren's generation, to profit from it. In other words, the prescription that was perfectly logical for climate coincided very much with the general green agenda. And if things had been done back in the 70s, so we wouldn't have the accumulation that we now have to get rid of. So what I'm suggesting is we have a big cleanup job to do if, in fact, all the gradual things of the general green agenda is going to work. What I'm suggesting is you really have to do a quick fix now to keep the world from having abrupt climate changes and all the other stuff that's begun to bother us big time.
I'm afraid we are running out of time. We have been talking with Professor William H. Calvin from the University of Washington. You can find out a lot more with links to his videos at williamcalvin.com or search his name on YouTube. Professor Calvin, I know that I'd like to have you back and really talk about these issues in depth. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith. We'll be talking with Dr. William Calvin again next week, after I play you one of the most shocking climate speeches of 2011, an outlook so grim I didn't want to play it for you during the holidays. For now, I just want to point you to a YouTube speech by Bill Calvin at the University of Victoria. Find that link in my blog at ecoshock.info, or just search William Calvin on YouTube. I also liked this quick introduction to that speech by Bill Calvin, and it was by Dr. Colin Campbell, another Aussie currently working on wild salmon in British Columbia, and he's chair of the Sierra Club of BC.
Dr. William Calvin, our guest today, is a professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and he's affiliated with its program on climate change. He's most recently the author of a book, Global Fever, How to Treat Climate Change, and he's written at least 13 other books for general audiences, averages one every 2 years. Think of that. His studies have included brain circuitry, ape to human evolution, climate change, and civilization's susceptibility to abrupt shocks. And he brings with him a lifetime of reflection on the great problems, the great questions of our time. He's worked on the leading edge of interdisciplinary practice. But most importantly, Bill brings some substance to what we've all come to realize, and that is that the behavioral challenge in meeting climate change is equal, if not greater, than the technical challenge of implementing the solutions that we've developed. If we don't really want to do what has to be done, and if we can't properly manage our motivation, then we surely will not succeed. Now, a great proportion of Dr. Calvin's research and writing has served to inform us about our neurophysiology, our brain, and our minds. And this is information that we need. I know from my own experience as a paleontologist that any interest in biological evolution immediately leads to an interest in climate, especially the climate history and the mechanisms of climate change. Because climate, more than anything else, routinely shifts the environment that all species must evolve to match. And it could be said from the point of view that species, well, let's say it this way, that the climate is the question to which species are the answer. And the species that's best answered the call of abrupt climate change is the human species. And Professor Calvin has really fully developed this simple notion in his really wonderful book called A Brain for All Seasons, Human Evolution and Abrupt Climate Change. This is an engaging account at many levels, but none more so than in recognizing that the conditions which brought about the evolution of humanity are similar to the kind of stresses that we're imposing on the planet ourselves right now. And it adds extra meaning, I suppose, to our notion of meeting our maker.
Climate change as our maker. I'm Alex Smith. Find out more on our blog at ecoshock.info. Plus our videos and tons of free MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. Join us next week as we find out just how tough that climate maker can be. Thank you for listening, and feel free to pass this program on to others who need to know.